Hello and welcome to the Serious Games Podcast, all about playful methods for interactive trainings and facilitation. Let's get started.
Welcome back to the Serious Games Podcast. And today, I welcome back Amy. I'm really happy that we will take the chance to, follow up on the first conversation we had on pen and paper roleplay. But today we want to look a little bit underneath the hood. So what's really happening with those stories and with those stories in teams, with that story making, that storytelling situation? Let's see how that unfolds. So first of all, welcome back, Amy.
Well, thank you so much for having me back, for the invite. I'm very excited. It's been a few years since we talked, so
absolutely,
probably some things have changed. Some things are the same.
Oh, yes, so true. So back in the days, together with Yasmin, we unpacked how pen and paper role play work in team situations. I guess we're going to just shortly tap into that. But then we also wanted to, and we met on a couple of, conferences and Play 14 and Manage Agile. And actually just yesterday we had coffee with Tom, which was also very nice. But we wanted to explore a little bit deeper that moment where this story is being created, made, maybe made up, where players or a team that normally have a role in their organization already. So why would they have yet another role in the game? Where they experience the, let's call it, magical power of a story, and how this can have an impact on them, not only in the game, but also afterwards, right? So, let's see. Let's see where we start. Now, I always like to start with two traditional questions, and these remain the same. Number one, what should our listeners know about you? And second, how do you describe pen and paper role play and that story making moment to someone who's never thought about this as an team intervention?
Right. So what should people know about me? I am super passionate about role-playing games, obviously. Tabletop role-playing games, as some people might also know them, especially in the English-speaking community. I'm not one of the people who has played since she was a child. I came in it in my early 20s, which can be considered quite late. I now, in my private round, I have players who have been playing Dungeons and Dragons for longer than I am alive, which is crazy. It's my big passion. It brings together all of my hobbies. It brings together fantasy and, fantastical worlds. I get to write a lot. I get to act, which I like. I get to meet my friends and I get to be creative. And I like to solve puzzles and mysteries. And all of these things can be encompassed in pen and paper and TTRPGs. I think, that's probably for this extent, the most important thing about me.
Absolutely. Wow. And what all this wonderful combination that you just explained, right? Like the creative moment, the acting moment, the fantasy and puzzle moment. Actually, you are using it in your free time with friends, yes, and fellow players. But how would you explain this setup with pen and papers for someone who's using this in the organizational context?
Right. So
let's say team or org development.
There's multiple aspects of this which you can use for an organization, right? So the creativity aspect alone, of course, can be used to break through the mold, as we say, to break some thought cycles, to create new ideas, to view something in a very different light than we normally do. The way we use it is more, I would say, on the, well, there's the social aspect of it, and then there's like the game-based learning aspect of it, or the story-based aspect of it. So in the social aspect, it is very much about people getting to know each other in a context that they never have. And the so fascinating, to me, most fascinating things about role-playing games, about these types of role-playing games, is you play a role, and on the surface, that might look like you're hiding behind something, or you're, you know, not being yourself. But in these roles, we always present ourselves in a very authentic way, in a very honest way, I think, because we think we can hide behind something. But the decisions that you make as this role that you're playing there, and out of every context that you normally make decisions in, right? It's like, I normally do not have to decide whether I would like to sneak by a guard, or bribe it, or, you know, just knock it out.
Hopefully not.
That's not a decision I'm making in my everyday life. But I make it as my role. If I, for example, play the rogue or the bard in my party, which are like the, you know, some of the traditional roles, like you have usually like fighters and mages and what have not, and rogues. And so what does it say actually about me? I mean, obviously I will have a character and think as this character, but also it might be quite a gut reaction if I'm like, oh, I'm going to try to sneak by, you know, like low risk of confrontation. Or I might try to talk to this person and try to charm them, or try to, yeah, to bribe them. Or I decide for the straightforward way of just knocking them out. And these approaches very often is something that we make unconscious, like we make them unconsciously. But these decisions show how we think about certain things. Right, and they show how we would naturally react to something, and this is something that we use in organizations when we play with them, when we play these stories with them. We can see how people react quite naturally, quite authentically to certain obstacles, and we also see how the people interact with each other. And even though they are in their roles, supposedly, they act as they would. So we see, we always ask afterwards, we always ask the teams, it's like, oh, what kind of dynamics did you watch the party having while playing? And do you also have these dynamics when you like work together in your everyday life? And the answer is always yes. So you will always see who is the de facto leader of the team. Like, who do people look to when a decision needs to be made? How do they make decisions, right? So we're talking on a bit of more on a more abstract level than, do you bonk this guard over the head or do you try to bribe them? We're talking about, how are you talking to each other? How is your decision making process? How many iterations do you go through? And these things always show up at the table in the game. But in this very different setting that allows people to observe themselves.
Yes. So a nice mirror, a nice safe mirror for team dynamics. And then you mentioned the second aspect, like this story-based learning. How does that play in? What are they learning, if not just, you know, seeing and observing themselves? What about this narrative that they're creating together, and the power that they have in the game to make up decisions, roll the die, experiment with stuff that I will never do in real life. And I can always say, oh, I wouldn't do this in real life. And how does that, and we're going to talk later maybe about this bleed in and bleed out effect, but how does that move or touch the player's real, is that real heart, real life, real day to day?
Yeah. There again are two aspects to this. The first aspect is on a very like straightforward, actually learning process. If you experience something, if you, and of course these stories that we tell are fictional, but you still experience them. You tell them together. And what we always say is like the story might be fake, but the emotions are real. And emotions are just such a strong anchor for memories.
Yes.
Right? They are such a strong incentive for remembering something. So things that you can tie to an emotion. For example, I was frustrated when we started discussing again after we already had made a decision. This frustration is what will stick to you. If you go into a normal team development and somebody says, well, it's going to frustrate you if you start the same conversation over and over, you will hear it and you will understand and believe it because obviously it's true. But the next time it happens, you might not remember that that was said to you. But if you manage to connect this feeling of frustration to, wait a minute, I feel frustrated because we are just starting this discussion over again. That is the learning aspect of experience-based learning, as we call it, right? So it's tied to emotions, and these emotions come from co-creating the story and living through the story. And then the other aspect is a bit more abstract. It's a bit harder to grasp, but when we play with other people, like we make play with other people in whatever form, we get to know them on a very different level. If you, and this is true for I think all games, if you play a board game or a video game and you register how the other person acts when they get angry, when they are, you know, what their strategies are. It tells you so much about this person. And the thing is, while we play, very seldomly do we not play as ourselves. Like we bring ourselves to in our play because we are, you know, playing as something that we start as children, and as a child, you do not have a work persona or a parent persona or a friend persona. You just have yourself, and playing, I think, is a very human instinct. We learn through play. We experience the world through play. We test out through play, right? It's like when we're adults, we're starting to call it like trial and error or like failing forward. But as a child, this is very naturally what you do. You play something, you do something, and it doesn't work, and you learn from it. And this is what we bring, what we try to bring back into the teams, is that they learn how to quite literally play together to work better together.
Gotcha. Okay. And it goes back to what you said also as a second point, right? With experiencing in a different context. So of course I did learn to behave, maybe to play a role, to adapt to a role in different contexts, right? Of course, work, maybe with one client, maybe with another client, with my family, right? With my friends, with my sport team, right? So of course, there are different contexts that also do have an impact on me. And I decide which, how to behave. Let me just put that way, what to do, which actions or decisions to take, and what to say and what not to say. So now I'm thinking, when are we really playing that role? And would we call it playing a role? Or how does that, you know, become visible? Because of course, you know, in your pen and paper, you know, session, it's clear that we're invited to play. But is there like a, let's say, is there like a session or something that, that just top of your head, top of your mind, something that, that makes what you just said so visible, like a scene that revealed everything that you just said for one team or maybe for individual players, something where you would say, well, look, we would have needed hours of, you know, other types of sessions.
The instance that always comes to mind when whenever somebody asks something like, oh, what was like the craziest or the most impactful moment that you experienced while doing this, was funnily enough really early on after when we started doing this, and we were doing a workshop with predominantly, I would say, well, in a flimsical way, would say old white dudes, right? Very lovely people. They all worked as some sort of insurance brokers, and they were all, most of them were between their 40s and their like mid 50s or something. And we were like, Yasmin and I are two young women, and we were even younger then. So it was a bit like, oh my God, like, how do we manage to get these people, these men who are, you know, turning up in their suits and being very professional and very, you know, proper, just proper people. And they now are supposed to roleplay people on an alien ship, like trying to investigate it. And we started, and everybody, you know, got into it splendidly, and it worked. And towards the end of the session, one of them had written a story for themselves. So we did not give that to them. They were like, oh yeah, I am here because I am looking for my brother, who was an original cast crew member on this ship that is now abandoned, and I want to know what happened to him. And they found this brother, unfortunately, deceased while exploring the ship. And then we had this moment of these two adult men really going into this role, and the one being upset about his fictional brother's death, and the other one really consoling him. And they really took their time to play this out and have this very emotional and vulnerable moment, where you could just feel the whole room shifting. Because obviously these were not emotions that were based in a real event, but nevertheless, they all felt in this moment, oh, somebody lost something, somebody's grieving, and somebody else is, you know, stepping up and consoling them and being there for them, even though these people did not really know each other. And it was just such a beautiful moment, because it was, you could really tell that somebody took a risk by, you know, going into this quite emotional and vulnerable role play, and the other person like took him up on it. And I think to this day, I think this was a great moment of building trust in that team and being like, because if you can pretend to grieve your dead brother and be sad about this, and somebody else pretends to console you about it, the decision to go to this point and then the decision to meet somebody there, I think is very beautiful. And there was a real emotional connection between these people at this moment, even though everything around them was fake, basically.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And let's unpack a little bit, you know, how to get to such moments, if they happen, but then also what to do afterwards, okay? Because yes, it might be a moment where someone has decided to show vulnerability in that context of, you know, the game, the story. And then the question is, yeah, how does that and did it and change them? Or wasn't that there anyway beforehand? And now it's just visible. And how does that not making such emotions or relationships visible, how does that impact our day-to-day? Yeah. So rolling back a little bit. Some listeners might say, look, I know role play. I've been in video games. I know those folks acting out, dressing up and acting out in the woods. Can we just, you know, give a little bit of orientation what pen and paper and tabletop role plays are? So I said video games on the one hand, steering a character, and then there's LARPs. Actually, there's also an podcast episode on that. I'll put that in the show notes. So there's LARPing, and then you are mostly sitting around a table, and you're not asking your players to dress up, but yes, to enact. Can you give us a little bit of clarity what you are doing, or what a pen and paper role play
yes,
is?
Yes, I think 20 minutes in the episode, it makes quite a lot of sense. to set the record straight. A pen and paper role playing game, or a tabletop, I think a tabletop role playing game describes it quite nicely. Yes, you do sit around a table, and everybody takes on the role of a fictional character. As I said before, in the very classical sense, that might be, you know, somebody might be a warrior, somebody might be a wizard, somebody might be a druid or some kind of healer, a bard. So you take on these roles, and you have one person at the table, the game master or the dungeon master, depending on how you play, who will set the frame, and they will describe a scene. It's like, oh, you're going through a forest, and somebody, all of a sudden, you hear something rustling besides you. And then the question is always, what do you want to do? And then each player can describe what their character wants to do, given the situation. So the warrior might say, oh, I draw my sword and get ready to fight. And the wizard might be like, oh, I concentrate my magic, you know, I concentrate on casting a protective spell, or I concentrate on making myself invisible, or, you know, whatever have they. And
yes.
That is basically how the story is told. So it's a back and forth between the game master and the players, with the game master describing the environment, all the people that might inhabit that environment, you know, things that might happen, what's the weather like, really anything to do with that. And the players decide how their characters want to act. And the besides the storytelling, the other very, very important part of classical TTRPGs are the dice. So you have dice as a storytelling element, basically, to see how things turn out. So the wizard might say, oh, I'm going to attempt a really, really big spell and make all of us invisible. Right. And that might require some sort of effort. And that this is a situation in which multiple things can happen. So you would usually, you know, throw a dice to see if that happens. So like, can the wizard pull it off, or will he just make themselves invisible? Will they make all of the characters invisible? Will he maybe shrink all of them because it's too ambitious, right? So you have these dice, which are sometimes just used mechanically to see, like, oh, do you hit something or not, right? Do you hit harder than the armor of your opponent is? That can be done by dice. But I always like to, there's this advice that you give to especially people who are new to running these games. So people who are new GMs, game masters, when they're like, when do I ask my players to roll? And the advice is always, you let them roll when failure is interesting.
Okay.
So when nothing happens, if they fail, they might as well just succeed. You know,
yes.
If it is interest, if something interesting that pushes the plot, that pushes the narrative forward could happen when they fail, then you let them roll. And this is how the dice are the storytelling element that nobody has control over. They really, really do. They tell their own story. That's a very common phrase, like, oh, the dice tell the story themselves. And they bring this element of chance, right? So you might be really good at something. Your warrior will obviously be very good at fighting. But the player might still roll bad. You might still have a low number or a bad number on the die. And then they will fail anyway. You can also be really good at something. Other way around. You can also be really bad at something, but roll really well. And then pull it off, which makes for a great story beat, right? And that's basically all that there is to it. So there's players, there's a game master, there's dice, and there's a story that you are creating together.
Wonderful. And that very important question, right? What do you want to do?
What do you want to do? Yes.
So a lot of decision making happening. And you keep the different players, aka the different characters, in play. So is there, I mean, how many colleagues could you play at one table? Is there a limit, like a healthy limit?
In a organizational context, like when we play with teams or at work, let's say, that depends a bit on what you want to do. Sometimes you want to play up the social aspect. You want people to have fun together. You want people to bond. You want to create this feeling of unity and, you know, this team spirit, let's say. For that, our personal, like, experienceable value is around 25 people, but that is the maximum. Okay. In general, the more people, the more chaotic, and the less every single person gets to contribute. Just, you know.
Okay.
It's math. Yes. It's like you have the same amount of time, but more people. If we really want to go deep into team dynamics, if we want to work on serious topics like how does the team handle stress? What does the team resilience look like? What are frustrations in the team? We usually cap it at 15.
Okay.
Because that is the number where you can still remember where everybody was sitting. So you still know, oh, you were sitting over there, you were playing this and this character. And that is also the number where if you go above that, you will have sub hierarchies in the team and you will have sub dynamics, which you always have, obviously. But we've done everything from, I think, 5 is the lowest, which would also be like a typical private round. If you play privately, you would, you know, anything between 3 and 7. 7 is a lot.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. And let's talk about what you just said, right? That you know, sub-dynamics, group dynamics, the group story. I mean, if it's a team. But also individually, as we mentioned in that early story that you shared, you know, you bring your set of beliefs, your emotions, your way of doing things, you bring that to the table, right? I mean, you're not a different person just because you're sitting down at a table. So let's talk about this bleeding effect, right? So when you enact as that character, right? That, as you already mentioned, right? Mirrors or shows I mean, who you are. Okay, that's maybe an exaggeration, right? But then also the other way around, things that you do experience, right, as a character, that feeling that sticks with you after the game too, right? I mean, you will look into the eyes of that colleague, even though you looked into their eyes during the gameplay. You know, there is something that will remind you, especially as you mentioned, we all know that emotional stories and moments stick longer, right? So what can you share? Can you give a concrete example where such a bleed in or bleed out moment really made a difference?
I think so that, yeah, the bleed in and the bleed out are common effect. Common. That's just what happens when you do role playing. You project yourself on the character, and the character in some way will reflect back to you. So bleed in is the term that we use to describe what do we bring into the play zone, basically. So when we play a game, we open a room, we open a space in which different rules apply than normally, right? And when we step into that space, we leave a lot behind. We leave a lot of obligations and, you know, context behind, but we bring something. You cannot bring nothing, because you're bringing yourself. Yes. that is the bleed in. And then the bleed out is the reverse. When you leave the space, you will leave the rules and the context of the game behind, but you will also take something from it. And, I think the best way I can, maybe but the best example I can give, it's not a very concrete example, but we often see that, especially the bleed out, when we have the team lead or the boss or whatever, they play with the team, so they do not get a special role or anything. They're just like a normal player in the game. And what we often see is that what they take is a better understanding and also more trust in the team, that they will be able to function even if the team lead is not around, because they've seen that in the game. Very often the team lead will, you know, take themselves out a bit of the game and let the others play, and then occasionally say something. And what they witness is that their team is indeed very capable of making decisions, of getting the work done, of communicating, and that they can witness this and build more trust, which also takes a big load off their shoulders, right? Because a lot of team leads are under a lot of pressure by thinking, oh, if like I need to lead these people, I need to be there for them, I need to give them direction, and I need to do this and I need to do that. And they realize that they can take themselves out because they've seen that. And then they take this, oh, the team did manage to defeat the dragon, and I was there, you know, maybe I said something at a crucial point. I said like, no, let's do it like this, or let's do it like that. Like I made a decision. But they are capable people. And that's something that we see a lot, is that the team leads, they see the people that they're leading still as their responsibility, obviously, because they are, but also as fully capable humans, I think is the best way I can describe it.
Okay. So what I hear is that obviously you, the game master, design, craft, frame, the narrative, the experience in that sense of it, invite the players, the AKA characters, to make decisions. And yes, when it's interesting that they fail, there might be this dice moment also involved. But literally what really happens, you cannot really control that, right? I mean, you can. Would you say you nudge it, you give it a direction, but is that possible? Maybe that's the first question. And secondly, if that's true, what you're saying, that, you know, leaders or maybe, you know, team members, depending on, you know, how the group is put together, that they observe now their fellow colleagues in their role. How much can you control this bleeding? I mean, is that something that you would just add while you frame and keep that narrative going as a game master? Is that something that you must decide at the beginning? I mean, when the briefing is happening, when you're crafting the story? Or is it, you know, something that you would even design in a character and who you give that character, or is it something else?
That is a big question. That is, yeah, a big question. It also goes deeply into game design and all of that. Yeah. The biggest goal for doing this in an organizational, or probably also in a private setting, the biggest goal for a game master is always to create the most immersion for the player, so that they really get into the story, they really get into the headspace of creating that story, of this world that you're describing. We always play in some sort of fantastical world. Doesn't have to be fantasies, can also be sci-fi. We once had garden gnomes that were alive, right? Mm-hmm. But you need to go into this other space, because in this other space is where we can see what we want to see and where we can do what we want to do with the teams. There's a few things that we do to increase this immersion. Really extremely relevant point is that the people can build their own characters. So we might bring them a framework for a character. We might tell them, oh, you're the wizard. But we will not tell them what kind of person they are. Right? So a wizard is probably smart and intelligent, but are you arrogant? Are you humble? Are you, do you help people? Do you use your magic for yourself? Are you aggressive? Are you defensive? How do you respond to certain situations? That we do never tell them. And we sort of let them finish these characters in the beginning of the game, because then it's your character. And all of a sudden it will matter what happens to this character. Right. Yes. If that character gets hurt or they lose something that's important to them, all of a sudden you lose that and you get hurt. And this is one of the things that we always design for, is that people take control of their own character and their own representation in that world, because then it matters. I think this is a very important part of this bleed in process, because you want as much as possible to bleed in, because then you will see how the team interacts with each other.
Gotcha.
Of course there are extremely very, very experienced role players who can if you've done this for, you know, a long time, if you're very good at it, or if you choose to play it that way, let's say it like that. If you choose to play, of course you can build a character that is fundamentally different from you and you bring nothing of yourself to the table, and you can hold that up for 3 to 4 hours. These people for sure exist, but it is not what we observe in the normal world. So like even yeah, my like in, my private players, my the my friends that I play in private with, some of them have been playing for like 30 plus years. I can still tell when I play with them, like I can all of the characters will have a commonality, and it's there, it's themselves, right? So the split in, it happens. You want to encourage it. We always want to encourage it without people really noticing. And do a design. Yeah. How do you design for it? I think what's also very important is that you as the game master also go all in, because you do not have your own character. Right, you play the world, or maybe you play a non-playable character. So the guard. If the rogue wants to bribe the guard, somebody has to act as the guard. That will be the game master, and you want to make sure that you also really go in and and give the energy into the scene, and sort of, you know, open the space even wider for people to act in. Because a lot of people feel, especially in the beginning, they feel a bit silly, right? It's a bit silly. We're all grown people and we're pretending to be dwarves hunting a dragon. It's like, yeah, it is a bit silly. That is the fun of it. You want people to not be self-conscious about that, right? So you want to give them the space to come to the table and bring themselves without thinking, am I making a fool of myself? And the easiest way to do it is that as the game master, you must be the biggest fool at the table. You must be over the top. You must take it seriously. It's a game, but you must take it seriously.
Yes. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So I think what I hear is really you design for that bleeding by allowing, letting, inviting the players to finalize, to describe, to build their character, to then build and be their character. And let's talk about this bleed out. So things happen. Again, you know, you mentioned, you know, this happens for a couple of hours, maybe. We play, we succeed. Sometimes we roll the dice and something sillier happens. And at one point it is over, okay? At one point we have to say goodbye to that context and joyful moment. Maybe, again, it's not joyful. It was hard. Maybe we lost someone, or we found someone, and now we're grieving. But at the end of the day, at the end of the play, we have to close and leave this magic circle of the role play. And what happens then? I mean, how do teams, individuals, leaders, how do you support that within the team and for the individuals? How do they make sense out of what they just experienced? I mean, probably a lot of things have happened, right? I'm still thinking about this, you know, safe space or brave space of the narrative. It's like, yes, but I would have never hit, you know, I would have never made that decision. I would have never questioned a decision. Yeah. You know, I don't do that in our meetings, in real life, in my day to day. But how do you help? How do you support? What are the mechanisms that work for you in your work so that this experience is transformed into understanding, learning in that sense making, and maybe even experiments, micro experiments, behavioral experiments that a individual or a team is then willing to follow up on or commit to in their day to day. What are your tips and tricks, and how do you do it?
So in the immediate aftermath, let's say, always depends a bit on how we work with the teams, right? Sometimes they will have something like a follow-up or that might have been the last point of the agenda for the day. Usually what we encourage is that in the immediate aftermath, everybody just sits for a minute and lets it sink in, because you do need time to get out of that space again, right? It's, you do need time to, because usually finale is, you know, grand and epic, and you either manage to do something or you fail and things happen, and you will still be very buzzed up from this, right? You're still like in the emotions, as we say. So you do need a time to calm down. So just like, you know, a few minutes of self-reflection, maybe just writing down what are you thinking right now? How do you feel right now? You know, just nobody will see it, just for yourself. What just happened? So that is, you know, a thing. And then we encourage the team to ideally sit together in a very loose environment. So at lunch or at dinner, or, you know, maybe they ordered some pizza and we'll have another beer afterwards. To just stay in this group and talk about the game, whatever they want to talk about. This is what happens in private groups too. Like, never, I think, has it happened that somebody was like, okay, that's it for the day, and everybody got up and left. Like, you stay, you talk about what happened, you talk about why that happened, you talk about what could have happened, and, oh man, if I had rolled the die better in this occasion, we would have, and then this wouldn't have. You know, so a collective, you stay in the narrative a bit, you stay in that world, but you already go one step back and view it from like an audience view, let's say. So you're not the actor anymore. You are now the audience who just saw the play and talks about it. And then the real work happens always in a retrospective that we do with the team. And the retrospective is what we cover and what we talk about is highly dependent on the team and what were the topics that we wanted to talk about. Also, what did we see in the game? What came up, right? So most of the retrospective will be the team themselves reflecting on how things happened. But of course, we as the game masters also see things, observe things that will be different from what the team themselves have seen, so that we will also give a bit of input. And then it basically always comes down to what happened that was good, what happened that frustrated you, why. And you take these fictional scenes. You were like, oh, I was so frustrated when I don't know, this dragon escaped because we couldn't decide what to do, and so nobody did anything. Like, okay, cool. Is that a dynamic? And now we're back at the very start. Is that a dynamic that you observe in your day-to-day life together? Do you discuss until the decision is made by somebody else or made for you, and then you haven't done anything? And as I said in the beginning, the answer is always yes, because you always see the real life dynamics at the table. Of course, a bit blown up, of course, a bit out of proportion. Like, we're not saying because you bribed the guard that you are, you know, that you would bribe somebody in real life. Like, we're not saying that, of course, but like, what happened? Why did it happen? And how did it make you feel? Right. And then we look at these things and the teams reflect on these fictional scenes, which is so beautiful, because even if something bad happened, nothing happened. Right. There's nobody, you don't need to find out. Nobody is in trouble for something, for the dragon escaping, because the dragon doesn't exist. But you can talk then very honestly and very objectively about why did this happen? Like, what were the mechanisms that led to that? And that is what makes this reflection on the game so powerful, is that in that moment, you can step out of the role and, you know, not be the person who did this, because it didn't really happen. It's a game, and the person that did that also doesn't really exist. And it just makes getting feedback, but also giving feedback, so different. It's on such a different level. Because it can be really hard to tell a colleague that you like. It can be really hard to say, it drives me crazy when you do this and this. Yes. It's really annoying when you do this and this, or you did a bad job, or this was not up to our quality standards. That can be a really hard thing to say to somebody that you know and you like. But saying, well, my character was really frustrated when your character didn't do this, even though they said they would, or, you know, didn't hold up our end of the bargain. That is a very different thing, because it's not, you're like once removed from it, and then you're twice removed from it because it's a fictional situation.
And again, I would say that's really what you then also design, right, into this experience that you help teams to either practice or to experience things that are helpful, you know, again, based on your experience, to then mirror back to make specific behaviors observable, right?
I think that's a very good way to put it, like to make them observable and to make them discussable.
Got you. But then, and that's what I also hear is, afterwards, the sense making in that retrospective, of course, mainly happens, you know, by the players, right? You are a game master, or you as facilitators, you know, who designed that intervention, that serious game, obviously are so there as a resource to mirror back, to share your observations, that's clear. But it's not that you are now dissecting and, you know, you didn't record this on tape, saying, okay, look, this is the behavior that you should never show in your day to day. But are there common, I mean, is that a question that I can ask? Let's see. Are there similar stories? Let's think about, you know, a topic that you have often facilitated, but are there similar topics that emerge? And if so, or even if not, here's my second question. What do you do with that then? I mean, now we have this retro. Is that a classical retro in terms of what do we learn about ourselves and what do we want to focus on, commit to become better?
Yeah, I think if you boil it down, right, we have always a range of topics, and every team is different because there's different, those made up of individuals. Of course, if we do a workshop, on the topic of team resilience and like burnout prevention or something, of course, everything will be different from we're doing a workshop on conflict communication or conflict resolution. But it really always, the method of using tabletop role-playing games to do this is always play and then observe the play and then talk about and then, you know, observe what happened. Is that good? Do you as a team want to keep that? Is that a good dynamic for you? Does that work for you? If yes, great. If not, you've now discovered this. What do you want to do about it in the future? Basically, most things, I would say 95% of all of the topics that we observe comes down to communication and in a bit of an extended way, like unstated and unset expectations that people think other people have of them. Mm-hmm. So communication, I think it's a very obvious, it's a very obvious pick for this is, we always think that we communicate clearly, right? Because we know what we mean. And the other person also thinks that we communicate clearly because they interpret what we said and that what we must have meant by saying this, mm-hmm. right? And the difficult comes immediately because very often teams are like, oh yeah, in our team, we value honesty. And that is great. But what honesty means for me and what honesty means for you are extremely different things, likely.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then you will get in trouble because somebody says like, I think your idea is, we should not do that. And here is my idea and we should do it like that. And then the other person is like, oh, but why would you say that? Like in front of everybody. And then it's like, yeah, but honesty is one of our values. And then the other person goes like, but that doesn't mean we, don't support each other. And it's really things. And the great thing about going about these things in a game is that you have these situations in which somebody was frustrated or somebody didn't understand something or somebody or something happened that people were not happy about. And then you talk it and you can break it down. You dig until you come to this fundamental thing of like, oh, I thought what you meant when you said was X, but now I see it was Y. And just the realization that we do not speak of the same things when we speak of the same thing. And then, but also understanding who is that person that I'm talking to, because the better I know somebody, the more context I have about somebody, the more likely I am to understand what they want to say to me. Right? The more shared vocabulary we have, the more shared context, the more shared narrative we have between the two of us, the better we will be able to communicate if we put the work in.
Mm-hmm. Got you. And then also for that shared values, context, narrative, and even if we discuss or agree to not agree that honesty means the same for us or not, I think it's also important to then understand that we're not aiming for one specific set of behavior and that everyone, let's say in a company or in a team, needs to behave exactly that way. But still, it must be healthy, and it must be a healthy way of respecting this value in your work stream, with your conditions, with the way that you decide to interpret it, so that it, enables us to do X, Y, Z, depending on what the goal is. Obviously, deliver value, but then on the other hand, to also have that, integrity within. Okay. And for that, I mean, now we're back to that retro, right? Experiments are defined, activities, follow-up activities are designed, but how do you, make best use of really this immersive experience, right? Is there anything else that you would recommend to a team, as generic as it can be, to do that follow-up? I mean, is it just the retro, or is there more that they can get out of these story-making moments, those role-play moments, tabletop, pen and paper moments?
There is, of course, a million things you can get out of it, right? Like whatever aspect you wanna look at, you will be able to facilitate something out of it. I think a big thing. So of course, like understanding these things and getting to, you know, wrapping your head around this is a very important step, but in and of itself, it doesn't do much. Like understanding is the first, and, you know, without understanding, you will not be able to proceed, but like just understanding also will not help. So what you of course want to do is like, what is the solution? I always like to look for the smallest possible adjustment you can make to break this dynamic if you decide you don't want to have it anymore. And here we can again go back to the game, because if you look at this game scenario in which, you know, let's stick with the example of, oh, we've discussed for so long and we just couldn't get a consensus, and in that time the dragon flew away and now we're screwed. If you have a situation like this that is so concrete, it is very easy to find a solution for that. Not very easy, but it is easy to find a solution for that. The solution obviously is not, well, next time we don't discuss as long, because that is, you know, that doesn't help. But you can look at why did we keep discussing? Like, do we need a time cutoff? Do we, should we have voted on it? Like, what? And then you can talk about how does the team, for the next time they run into this, how do they want to resolve it? And they can creatively work on a solution to that. That they then can then like see how they will implement it into their workflow, right? So that is of course what needs to happen in the retrospective. It's not just addressing and observing and, you know, presenting these things, but also addressing how do we want to deal with this now? So that is a big thing. But there is also other things. Like, you can also look at creative problem solving, right? It's like very often in these games, or like after the games, people come to us and we're like, I didn't know we were so creative as a team. I didn't know we had so many ideas. And then you go like, why are you normally not that creative in your work? Like, what's hindering you? Like, and how do you in your work manage to open that space again in which you can be creative, right? Because usually work is protocols and like sort of fixed procedures. Like, you have your job and your role and there's no time or no space. Then you play and you realize, oh wow, we have a lot of potential for doing things, for solving problems, but we need that space. So the question becomes, how do you open that space? Who opens it? When do you do that? Do you set time aside for that, right? And how do you rephrase the things that you're working on into something that you can then work on creatively? So that for sure is a huge part of it.
I was just trying to, you know, say that's really, and I will let you answer, you know, with more thoughts on what you can get out of it. But this is really, when people say play compresses time, right? And there's so much happening in an hour, two, three, four a day of play. And we really need to be intentional as facilitators, again, using this as a serious game, huh? With what we mirror back, what we make observable or help them to make observable, and how we create that safe space to, you know, offer alternative patterns or alternative ways of behavior, place and space for experimentation. And then as you mentioned, yeah, that debrief and then that intentful way of, hey, what do I really want to get out of it? And what emerges, right? And we also need to be open to allow that new novel idea and behavior to emerge. Yeah. But you also had another idea that you wanted to share on what one could get out of the pen and paper.
It cannot have been that important because I already forgot.
Oh, good.
Of course I remember. What you get out of it is a great sense of identity, of team identity. Who are we together? What happens if we all work towards the same goal, which you will do in a typical TTRPG story? You will get a very, this very short span, you will get a very clear goal of, deal with the dragon or infiltrate the castle or escort this noble person somewhere, right? And the goal is also very clear to everybody. And so whenever something happens that you need to overcome, it might just happen to this one character, right? So this one character might be attacked or might step into quicksand. And that is, first of all, the problem of this character, but there's never a question that the other characters will try to rescue them, ever, right? Because they need this character and they all have the same goal and they look out for each other. And this translates into an understanding of what does it mean to be a team? Because very often in our work, we have our set tasks and we do these tasks. And if we get stuck or get lost or, unsure of what to do, we are like, oh, but this is my problem. I need to figure it out instead of asking for help. Because you do not want to bother somebody or you don't want to seem incompetent, right? You're like, oh my God, what will they think if I... But in these games, of course they're going to help you out of the quicksand. Like nobody, you don't even have to ask. Of course they will do it just because they see you are in trouble. And this thing of also cope this, right? So you have what actually happens in the story. You have this shared sense of a vision. But you also create something together because you create this story. Because as we said in the beginning, I, as the game master, have a limited influence on what will happen. I know where they start and I know where I want them to end. Everything in between and how they get there and what the actual, they will confront the dragon. The dragon will show up at some point. That is my plan. Beyond that, how well they are prepared, if they made a plan, what happened before, if they are maybe already, hurt or something, if how many they are, if they brought somebody with them. All of that is none of my business as the game master. Yes. I just react.
Gotcha.
So the players and this team, they really create this narrative together. And building something with somebody else is an enormous bonding experience, right? Really, and then afterwards you look at it and you're like, oh wow, we did that together. Look at what we created. Look at what we did. And again, it doesn't matter that it's fictional. It just does not matter. It's memories that you now share.
Yes.
And that makes it real in your head, right?
Yes, emotionally. Created or stories with emotion, like emotion as the glue of this co-creative moment, and then it stays and bleeds out. Wow. I'm just looking at our time.
I know.
And, just another hour we could talk. And maybe I just want to close maybe just want to ask you, so if the pen and paper experience is like a walk through the team's garden of communication and expectations and moments of co-creation, if now a listener wants to use the power of storytelling, it doesn't have to be in TTRPG, but if they want to get started with story making, storytelling moments or interventions. What is your tip? What is your ultimate tip to use that power?
Oh, this is hard because I always know, because I always say everybody can play TTRPGs and everybody can use them. Mm-hmm. And that is true. Mm-hmm. However, the entrance barrier can seem daunting. Most people do not know about TTRPGs or have heard something about them. And then they Google and you will be instantly lost. There are so many different systems. There is no coherent starting guide. And then you will find starters for, let's say, Dungeons and Dragons, which is like the biggest TTRPG. And you need to read several books. That is not good starting. What you really just need is players and a game master, and the game master needs to prepare some sort of storyline, some sort of hook, some exciting incidents that can happen, and ideally some dice, right? Mm-hmm. That is what you really need. The, let's call it, art of facilitating with it. I think if you've never done it, or if you are either a facilitator or a GM, but not both, it will be challenging to do both at the same time. Because while you're DMing, you're very busy. Your head is very busy with keeping the world alive, thinking of all the possible consequences, reacting to your players, you know, also thinking about, oh, where do I want to go? All of these things. And then also simultaneously having a look at, oh, how are they behaving? What do I need? Like, you know, where does it need to go? That will be challenging, but it is doable, I would say. The tip is to make the smallest story possible that you can think of. Really, the easiest setting. And if you think, oh, but that will be boring, your players will make it not boring. They will take it and they will run with it. You just need to give them the space. And I think that is the other very important advice. As a GM, you cannot and should not control where the narrative flows. The best thing would be to just, you know, get them some characters, let them finish these characters, some questions like, here is a wizard, and then here's three things the wizard can do, and then some questions like, what is your specialty in magic, or do you come from a magic family, or are you like a prodigy or something? You know, just something so that they can make something up. Give them very easy characters, and a very easy scene. Like, you go through a forest, there's something rustling in the bush, is a perfectly valid scene. And then just think of what that will be. And, you know, you will fill 20 minutes easy.
Yeah.
My tip is to really not overthink the prep and more focus on what do you want to get out of it, right? And what do you want to create with that? And of course, the other tip that, if I may shamelessly plug it, you can call us. We do this for a living.
Yes. absolutely.
We do this for a living. We're called 12 or higher. We've done this for a while. And hit us up. Look up our webpage, find us on LinkedIn, whatever floats your boat. Also, contact us when you want to start yourself, but just do not know how.
Yes.
We're always happy to talk.
Wonderful. And I will make it easy to find you. I will put all the links and the LinkedIn profiles, and I will put any resource that you shared with us. And of course, the interview that we have recorded a couple of years ago, also in the show notes. And yeah, there's many, 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 many more things to explore. Maybe you could also share a few links, Amy, of the conferences that you're on. I know that you're hosting sessions and that there's multiple ways of getting in contact with you or your dear colleague, Yasmin. And I thank you so much for being on this show for the second time.
Well, thank you. Had a lovely time as always. Always happy to come back in, you know, a few years. I'm sure we will have more to talk about.
For sure.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
To all our listeners, check it out. Get in contact with Amy. Find the next possible smallest step to explore either your first tabletop role-playing game. And with that, I wish you a lot of fun and success. Till the next time, you're Julian.
You can reach us at hello@keylearning.net. We're looking forward to your suggestions, comments, and feedback.